This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Let's bring in our next guest here, Melissa Baker. She's the founding partner of Fenwick Brands, a female-led consumer-focused investment firm. Melissa, thank you as always for joining us. How are you doing?
Great. Happy to be with y'all today.
We're happy to have you. Well, let's dive right in here. Retail, consumer packaged goods. I'm a markets gal. From a stock market perspective, these stocks have been doing really well because people are saying in the time of a recession, everyone's going to need food. Everyone's going to need these kind of basic items. So naturally, you have to invest in those shares. But talk to us about the trends in this industry right now.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting time. I think, you know, if I put my investor hat on, you know, we are focused more on earlier stage consumer businesses. And it's interesting, you know, we're coming off this period of what I would call, you know, overinflated and overinvested markets where we saw a lot of capital come into the market, pressure to get it to work, causing really high valuations and really kind of growth prioritized over profit. You know, fast forward to today, you know, I think the positive news is we're starting to see some much needed course correction. You know, you're right. Consumers need staples. But more importantly, we need these earlier stage businesses to build healthy and profitable companies. And I think we're starting to become prioritized again.
Melissa, I just want to jump in here because we don't have a ton of time. I'm wondering how you're seeing this course correction play out in the private side as a private equity investor, what you're hearing from your portfolio companies, which include Ursa Major, Lemmy Shine, Madison Reed, Back to the Roots, among others. What are you hearing from them about course correction right now? Are they under pressure?
Yeah, I think, look, everybody's under pressure to just maintain some consistent levels of growth. But I think we've got strong value propositions to the consumer. I think we're being much more thoughtful and discerning as we think about, you know, omni-channel models and where the product is and being with the consumer where they are in purchase. And I think all of our companies are well positioned, but definitely long-term minded, right? And really focused on loyalty and retention.
So what are you worried about here? What keeps you up at night?
Oh, lots of things keep me up. But no, I think, look, consumers are evolving, right? And they purchase with their head and their heart. And I think the definition of brand and the value of brand to the consumer is ever-changing. And it's important for our companies to be well-positioned, right? They have to solve for the purchase friction. They have to meet the consumers where they are in the head and the heart in well-developed omni-channels. And so for me, it's like, look, we've got good value propositions, but we just need to be with that consumer. And the consumer's changing, and that's a constant struggle and opportunity for our businesses and making sure we're well-positioned.
Melissa, you know, it's so funny. I moderate a panel at Milken with a bunch of folks in private equity, and I think every single one of them was based in New York City. And you're joining us from Birmingham, Alabama, where you're based. And I'm wondering how that goes. And I mean, if you think about it, you know, we see it so much of the focus here in New York City. So how does it help and how does it hinder you at points to be based there?
Yeah, well, look, I think, look, we're a hidden gem, right? And I think we've got a great portfolio. So I think our portfolio and our reputation, you know, speaks for itself. But I will say that we're very relational. And I think, like, sometimes being a non-coastal, you know, we have a different approach to kind of middle of America lens on, right, the consumer. And the consumer's not just in coastal cities. And I think we have, right, we kind of leverage that mindset and being where we are to our advantage. And I think we bring something, right, that's a little bit different to the table.
Let's start and talk very quickly about just being a female-led investment firm. I think that's incredible. Walk us through perhaps a little bit of your perspective being a female founder in a private equity business. We got about a minute here.
Yep. I took a very unconventional path. You know, I was a classical musician turned marketer turned, you know.
I'm sorry, classical musician?
Yes.
What did you play?
A violin.
Violin. Very cool. I did that in the second grade. Was not a classical musician, but nevertheless, continue, Melissa.
Yeah. Yeah, nonetheless, I'm not your typical kind of, right, PE pedigree. You know, for me, it was about leveraging all of my in the trenches operating expertise to small brands that needed help. We saw an inefficiency kind of in the funding market between VC and PE, and where partnership and value-added capital really could make a difference. And I think for us, being a female-led firm, we're the consumer. We gain conviction of the product early, and I think we can bring more EQ to the partnership. Building companies is hard. It takes time. I think there's lots of pivots, right? And I think it's not just a spreadsheet, but it's a relationship and a partnership. And I think we kind of can bring a little more of the relationship and the empathy to the table with these companies and kind of what they're going through. And yes, we have the capital. Capital is a commodity. It's everywhere. But I think for us, it's like how you capitalize on the pivots and how you manage through growth inflection. And I think that, you know, takes a lot of work and handholding, and we bring that relational piece to the puzzle as well.
Melissa Baker, really great to have you back on Bloomberg Businessweek Radio. Thanks for joining us once again. She's founding partner of Fenwick Brands, joining us on the phone from Birmingham, Alabama.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a story featured in the new issue of Business Week magazine, written by Alex Barinka, technology reporter for Bloomberg News, is all about how one of TikTok's biggest stars is roasting dudes for misogyny and racism. Alex Barinka is technology reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us from our Los Angeles bureau. You can see her on YouTube if you're watching us there. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So Joel, it's so funny. We're talking about a person named Drew Afualo. And, you know, we think about the power of the people have with these platforms. She has got 7.5 million followers on TikTok. So it's fewer than Justin Bieber, but she's got like as many as Jimmy Fallon.
Almost as much as Jimmy Fallon. Yeah. And yet, you know, not
big.
Maybe not a household name. And it just speaks to how well she owns TikTok. And on top of that, we're working on a special issue this week. You're going to see some more stories that are going to be thematically linked to this one. This was the first out of the gate. And it was also just totally caught our attention from the moment that Alex flagged this as an option, because Drew, in the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision, that basically, you know, upended Roe versus Wade. We're thematically talking about that this in this week's issue. And this is a sort of a surprising silver lining to all of that, which is how laughter can actually become a weapon. Alex, tell us more about Drew's approach here.
Yeah, and you know, you say she's not a household name, but if you're on TikTok, she is absolutely a household name, for better or for some of these misogynistic type online trolls, for worse. Drew is a character who's really increased in popularity over the last year. We got to chat for this story. She is sharp, she is witty, but she also cares really deeply about women who she says she's protecting on the platform. If you see a Drew video in your feed on TikTok, you'll be scrolling and a video of a guy will typically pop up saying some pretty awful things. They're either racist, they're sexist, they're fat phobic. And then all of a sudden Drew's face will cut in, usually with her kind of trademark laughter, cackling at these men. And she basically kind of dismantles them. And she does it in a really interesting way. Drew is very smart and clever, and she makes some really like logical points and basically picks apart these guys with logic. But she also takes these tactics that online trolls are really known for: comedy, commenting on people's appearance, telling the guy he's already going bald, and kind of wraps the logic in this wrapper of these same tactics that online trolls like to use when they go after women on the platform. And I'll tell you, I've seen these guys take down videos or just like completely delete their accounts. They don't take it as well as maybe some of their victims do. So she's really kind of established this role for herself, almost this like folk hero type role, going after guys who are kind of awful on the internet.
Kind of awful.
No shortage of those guys.
I was going to say.
Is that editorializing too much?
Alex, you should know the minute you said balding, there was a major reaction in the control room and studio. One I was not prepared for, I will admit. Alex, let's talk about the approach that TikTok takes here. The internet makes it very easy for people to say all sorts of things. It's also, I think, something social media platforms have really tried to address. Walk us through how maybe that's not enough.
Yeah, so the platforms are a little bit reactive, right? They might ban certain words or allow creators to mute words or block people. But these guys will kind of take tactics that that stay a step ahead, or trolls, to speak more generally. If they are banning things like quote, "I hate fat women," and folks notice that language is getting banned or taken down for bullying by the platforms, they'll change tact and say things like, "I only love men who weigh less, women who weigh less than 120 pounds." So the platforms are, whether it's TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, they all have policies in place to kind of combat bullying. But look, frankly, these bad actors on the platform move a lot quicker and speak in different languages or use code that is very well recognized by people on the internet. But it's this little bit of a game of kind of whack-a-mole. What Drew's been able to do is basically keep up with the times and kind of, slide a knife through these guys online and keep up with what they're saying and how they're kind of skirting these rules. So there's some things out there. A lot of it depends on fans, followers, or people on the platforms to report things themselves. But, you know, if you can stay a step ahead, then maybe that hand-to-hand combat is a little bit more fierce in the moment.
It just feels like she may have like no shortage of options to pick from. And I'm curious, did you put that towards her? Like, how does she pick who she takes down?
Yeah, so initially she would kind of, I'm talking a year and a half ago when she started this this kind of path. She would look for guys and find them who are kind of saying awful things. These days, she wakes up to thousands and thousands of notifications across all platforms. She has those notifications turned off because there are so many of them. But a lot of times now, her fans, her followers will actually tag her in videos of people who are going after women or who are, slewing racist, misogynistic, or fatphobic comments on the platform. There's another camp. There's a lot of folks who like to attack her. So those are coming straight into her notifications as well. But, you know, it seems like there's a lot out there. I will say, she did tell me that it's getting a little bit tougher to find guys that she hasn't roasted before or subject matter she hasn't roasted before. So, you know, whether that's because she's doing her job too well as she sees it or if things are cracking down a little bit, who knows?
She should come over to Twitter.
But a lot of these things are referrals.
Yeah, she should come over to Twitter. I see a lot of this stuff there. Hey, Alex, just in the last minute that we have with you, can you talk a little bit about the business of somebody with 7.5 million followers on TikTok? Like, how does she make money?
Yeah, absolutely. So Drew wouldn't divulge exactly how much she makes, but she will say she's making a living off of it. There are a few venues for somebody like her to make money. The platforms do pay out a small amount if you're in something like TikTok's creator fund. But when I talk to creators across the platform outside of just Drew, they say that's basically coffee money or lunch money. Where they make a lot of their money is on brand sponsorships, brand partnerships, where they'll post sponsored posts with clothing or other products. Drew also has a podcast, so folks will start to venture outside of the platforms as well for opportunities for advertisers or sponsors to work with her. So mostly platforms, sponsorships, or other partnerships is where a lot right. of these folks are making money these
well,
days.
Well, it's a great story, Alex. It highlights a really important issue, and certainly somebody I think who's not a household name for people who are not on TikTok, including myself. Alex Brinca, technology reporter for Bloomberg News. Check out her story in the new issue of Business Week magazine on the Bloomberg and online now.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Creedy, when we talk about the health of the markets, we not only look at the equity market and the bond market, of course, but we also look at trends that we've seen this year, IPOs, M&A, and what's actually happening in the space. And it was interesting because in the first half of 2022, we saw quite the decline when it came to IPOs and new deals. We are still seeing, though, some M&A activity. I mean, what comes to mind last week is the Frontier Sprint merger getting dropped and then JetBlue coming in and being the company that comes in and tries to make that acquisition. Let's get an update on the health of M&A right now. Mark Cooper is CEO at Solomon Partners. Mark this afternoon joins us on the phone from New York City. Mark, how are you?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
Doing pretty well. So if we were doing this conversation a year ago, I think our conversation would be a lot different because we would be coming off of this, you know, first half of the year that was just so hot when it came to M&A, when it came to IPO. SPACs were on the decline because 2020 was kind of the peak for that. So we saw that coming. Help us understand where we are right now, though, as we get into August of 2022.
You know, I think we're in a reasonably good market. You know, you can't look at 2021 and compare it to anything. It's a once in a generational market for M&A. It was hitting on all cylinders for all kinds of reasons, which no need to go into right now. But the fact of the matter is, yeah, we're off considerably from last year, but we're tracking only modestly down to 2019, which would be the first sort of comparable clean year, if you will, which was a very good year.
Are they different types of deals happening this year than last year?
Well, yeah, I think you're seeing more going private transactions, and that would be natural given stock prices have been lower. I think you're seeing a higher percentage of transactions being done by private equity buyers. And interestingly enough, you're seeing probably more in volume of mega transactions than you saw last year. Now, that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with macroeconomic conditions. It could be everything about just specific transactions, like, you know, like Musk buying Twitter for $44 billion. That could move the needle pretty significantly. But the private equity community still has, I don't know, $1.5 trillion of excess capital around. And, you know, one interesting aspect of the market this go around versus 2008 is the whole private credit markets. It's the debt markets. So traditionally, stock markets went down as they did, and interest rates go up as they are. The public debt markets just closed down. They shut, which happened, you know, for a couple of weeks or a couple of months this year. But what really is going on is the private credit markets are stepping in and picking up the slack. And the private credit markets don't care as much about near-term volatility. What they care about is credit and return on capital. So while interest rates going up slightly, it's still working.
Well, speaking of interest rates going up slightly, is, I feel like, an understatement. But isn't there this incentive built into the market here that if, I mean, I think a five-year-old could say this, if your, say, allowance is worth less tomorrow, given an inflationary environment, it makes sense to spend it today.
Hold on. You're saying that a toddler can do time value of money?
I'm saying you can, yeah. If you tell a toddler.
My 3.5-year-old's got a way to go.
If you give your 3.5.
Ari, can your daughter do this stuff? No. Okay.
Come on, Tim.
All right, this is like business school stuff. Continue, please.
Thank you. Yeah. If you give a child a quarter and say, this quarter is not going to get you a Rubik's Cube or a candy bar or whatever tomorrow, they're going to say, I have to spend it today. It's true.
Hey,
it's
there,
simple.
Kid.
Okay. I'm clearly speaking to a different era. Anyways, Mark, my point is that there's so much cash on the balance sheets right now. This is going to be worth less tomorrow, just given the inflationary environment. Why aren't we seeing more M&A?
Well, you know, you got to be careful with that concept. It's worth less tomorrow unless you invest it well, right? So the answer is corporations aren't going to essentially do M&A because they think it's the best, because they think it is just simply a good rate of return on their capital. I mean, yes, of course, rate of return comes into play, but they're looking at strategic issues. They're looking at, you know, do they have better investment opportunities within their existing business? So they look at a whole myriad of things. They're also looking at the health of their business. And frankly, the flip side to your argument is, with inflation as it is, consumer demand dropping, and for consumer-driven companies, I mean, that could suggest that they're going to have a fall off in their business, and so they might want to be conservative. Now, to the ultimate point is, if you look back on 2008, that was a great time to be a buyer, because when do you want to buy? You want to buy when things aren't so great. You're buying at better prices, theoretically, and hopefully you're buying assets that weren't necessarily available to you before, when the markets were so robust and there was such great demand. So
wait,
you get strategic assets and.
But Mark, you said the best time to buy was 2008, and a lot of that, I mean, going back to, I think, a very famous call made by Norway's major state fund, is that you buy tech in 2008 and you do super well for, I think, up till now, really. And I'm wondering, but one of the biggest kind of tailwinds for that trade was that tech was really using a lot of the cash that they had in terms of acquisitions, which brings me back to the M&A story. You have so much cash on these tech balance sheets, they're not able to spend it because of the antitrust scrutiny. So how do you make any sense of that?
So you brought up a couple of points. You're right. Antitrust is probably, in my view, the biggest issue, headwind issue that we have in M&A, or one of the biggest issues, certainly. Obviously, the economy being the other, macroeconomic conditions obviously being very important. As it relates to tech buyers doing roll-up strategies, I don't think that's stopping. We're talking about larger transactions now. And as you do tuck-ins, I mean, you see it happen all the time, and they're continuing to do them. Now, antitrust is the big issue, and that won't stop, in my view. And you're right, that was a great opportunity for success. And you're right, 2008, because it was a down year and it was a tough year, obviously, Great Recession, that was a great time to be a buyer. And I'm not suggesting it's not now a great time to be a buyer, but there are a lot of considerations.
Mark, does it become a better time to be a buyer in the remainder of 2023, or 2022 rather, and into 2023? I mean, what's your call for this moving forward?
So I think it's a good time. I think you have to be selective. And no one knows, are we in a recession or are we going to be in a recession? What's the demand profile going to look like going forward? How business is going to perform? So far, earnings have been good for Q2. You know, I'm bullish long term, and I don't know what long term means. So my attitude about buying is, this is probably a pretty good time to buy if you've got staying power and a long hold period. And strategics obviously do. And if they're doing something that is that is additive to the business, that has savings and synergies, that pushes them forward.
Right.
in a positive direction? And the answer is yes. And from financial buyers, they are continuing to invest. They're not stopping.
Mark, we only have 20 seconds left. Tell us some industries to keep an eye on.
I think it's going to be across the board. I think healthcare seems to be active. Industrials seem to be active. Business services, which has been a great middle market business for private equity. And then finally, I think tech will continue to be important.
All right. Mark Cooper, CEO of Solomon Partners, this afternoon joining us on the phone from New York City, talking all things M&A.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. You drive,
say it crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, well, here we go. We got 9 minutes to go in trading today on this first day of August. We just heard the numbers from Charlie Pellett, but worth another check here as we're pretty much flat on the NASDAQ. We're down just about a little more than 0.1% on the S&P. The Dow's in the green, but just ever so slightly. This comes after just a monstrous month, the best rally for stocks since 2020 in the month of July. Really curious to hear what Lisa Shalit has to think of it. She's Chief Investment Officer for Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley. Lisa joining us this afternoon on the phone from New York City. Lisa, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
All right, so where are you when it comes to whether or not the bottom is in here? Are you in the Mike Wilson school, or are you in the idea that, okay, well, we got a bottom in here?
Absolutely not. So, you know, Mike Wilson is a dear colleague of mine and heads up our global investment committee along with us over here at the wealth management business at Morgan Stanley. And I think, you know, our perspective is that investors have made a lot of assumptions here, assumptions about inflation peaking, assumptions about peak Fed, assumptions about the fact that, you know, multiples should expand as, you know, interest rates plummet. And our view is that, look, while some of that narrative may be beginning to take shape, there's big elements of it that remain unknowns. And the single biggest element is where are we really in this earnings trajectory? And can corporate earnings really hold up against this backdrop that we're seeing? You know, are we really going to see corporations resist a recession if that's what the bond market's pricing? We don't think so.
But Lisa, how much of this is a waitings game in that, similar to 2020, when there was that amount of uncertainty, everyone just kind of flocked to big tech names that have a lot of cash on their balance sheets because it was the cash that could kind of cushion them from that recessionary blow? We're now in an environment where I would argue a lot of the S&P 500 companies have a ton of cash on their balance sheet as a byproduct of those extremely low rates. So can't that help cushion it from any sort of recessionary blow?
I definitely think that is the case. And we are quite bullish on the longer term outlook for the economy once we get through this Fed rate hiking cycle because of the health of balance sheets. But we do think that what we've seen in Q2 so far from companies is a little bit of an illusion in terms of the read-through being, oh, look how resilient everybody is. Remember, when Q2 began, the Fed was really kind of at 75 basis points on Fed funds. A lot has happened, and policy operates with a lag. It still remains to be seen what real levels of demand are going to be for folks' products. If inflation is really rolling over, so is all this wonderful pricing power that companies claim to be taking as a way of helping them make the numbers. And the bottom line is, when you really take a step back, we're starting to see negative operating leverage, meaning sales of the S&P 500 are growing more quickly than profits. And that's what tends to happen just as inflation peaks. But our sense is that, you know, that as quickly as that those pricing gains came in to corporate earnings, they're going to go out. That's just not in the forward estimate.
So, Lisa, it raises the question about where the opportunities are right now for our investor audience. If you get new money, how are you deploying it? Where are you putting it?
Yeah, so we're, you know, looking for places where the recession is already fully valued and they're very low expectations.
Sounds like you are saying there is going to be a recession.
We actually don't think that we know that for sure. And actually, Our base case is that we escape one. But that's why we're looking for areas of the market where expectations are washed out, where a recession is already priced, whether we get one or not. And so we're finding that in some small and mid-cap stocks. We're finding it in healthcare. We're finding it in financials. We're finding it in energy stocks, which we think are going to continue to surprise on the upside. So those would be some of the places that we're looking.
Hey, Lisa, jump on. I want to go back to I should say Creedy. Excuse me. I want to jump in here.
Yeah.
A listener is getting in touch right now, and he wants to know where inflation is turning over, a comment that you made a little earlier. Where are you seeing that specifically?
So we're seeing it in two places. So obviously at the gasoline pump and in, oil prices more broadly in commodities. Those are things that the market is telling you have definitively rolled over as part of that commodities trade. We've seen industrial metals, things like copper, rollover, et cetera. Perhaps more powerfully, we're seeing it in the manufacturing surveys, where manufacturers are now telling us that prices paid are coming down hard. For example, we got the ISM survey this morning, and that index of prices paid came down really hard. Last month, we were running that index at 78.5, and today it came in at 60 versus an expectation of 74.3. So prices do look like on one level they are moderating. Certainly, we haven't seen that in wages yet. We haven't fully seen it in housing prices and rents yet, as those tend to be, you know, lagging. But we have begun to see the front end of some of those supply chain related problems in commodities and gasoline easing up.
Lisa, we've got about a minute here. How concerned are you about liquidity as we talk about really unprecedented amount of quantitative tightening?
Very. And this is another element where I think the market may be premature in its conviction that the coast is clear. We are, going to move into a very dangerous seasonal time for the year in the best of seasons, right? Summer tends to be, August in particular, tends to be a tough liquidity chapter. We're accelerating and ramping up QT in the month of September and into October.
Right.
So liquidity here, as these rates kick in with a lag, we believe folks should, keep their seat belts buckled and wait and learn, because we really haven't been here. These are somewhat uncharted waters.
Lisa Shalit, Chief Investment Officer for Wealth Management at Morgan Stanley, joining us on the phone from New York City. Lisa, always great to chat with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.